Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, now in summer mode.
Yeah.
Really summer and intercession mode.
I'm wearing sandals.
It's super.
That's how I know.
It is super quiet out there.
That's my protest.
Glad to be joined today by Texas Politics Project besandaled research director Josh Blank.
Save the rest of the description for later.
I think besandaled is something. I think I'm, have to look that up.
Yeah.
I think you can just, that's
just
kind sandaled. Of word you can make up.
I think you'd be sandaled, but
Or sandaled,
yeah.
Yes.
All right.
So, quiet at UT, a lot of interim hearings going on at the legislature, which, as I think about it, not a lot of headlines, but, have been kind of had those on in the ambient.
Mm-hmm.
In the ambient atmosphere in the last week have been working on other stuff, but a lot going on and, people are there and stirrings of what is coming up.
Right.
And,
definitely a lot of
stirrings.
Subject
of other podcasts, but, a lot of, so there are things going out there in the ether. A few items have been big in the Texas politics and ecosystem and media sphere, if you will, this week. And it seems like a good time to use a couple of them as points of departure and, maybe suggest some ways to be connecting the dots. Again, today, really thinking a lot about the election, the fall election sort of looming large in our world. But as part of what we're going to talk about, if not necessarily in the rest of the world as summer starts. But, just to dive right in, I think the two things we want to talk a little bit are, about the signs and commentary on a subject that we started on a bit last week and then put up a post at the Texas Politics website. If you haven't seen that at texaspolitics.utexas.edu, it's on the front page. And this is people paying attention to signs of a possible Republican enthusiasm, mobilization, turnout issue.
Right.
At least as we're looking at things now that could be looming for the fall election. And then, more on how border security and immigration might be playing into the election as issues, and in particular on the how it feeds into the Republican efforts to frame the agenda for the fall
mobilization
election.
Challenges potentially.
And it ultimately ties into the first theme. So we'll kind of tie these things together. But, let's start with this more direct issue of enthusiasm, mobilization, and Republican Party. And the catalyst, I think, for the more public discussion was not what we wrote. I didn't really push it out very much, but that piece kind of came up with some other things anyway that maybe we'll get back to. But the trigger for this was a memo from Chris Perkins, well-known Republican pollster. It's funny, in his company, Ragnar Research, that flagged signs of Republican disengagement. It was funny. I think of Chris as kind of a relatively new entrant, but that's one of those age things and been around a while thing. When Quorum Report kind of broke the memo or pushed the memo out as a hot buzz on Sunday, I think. There was this veteran GOP pollster, and then I was like, oh, Chris.
But right.
Yeah, Chris has been doing this now for 20 years.
Fair.
More,
so. Fair characterization.
Fair characterization, and Chris is great, friend of the Texas Politics Project and of ours, et cetera. But Chris's memo was very interesting, and then it did echo things that we've talked about here and that I've referenced hearing in Republican circles and that we've kind of noticed a little bit in our data, but it really has kind of popped up in some of the discussions among conservatives and Republicans that, I've been a part of recently.
Absolutely. Yeah, me too.
And there were kind of two points in Chris's memo, I think two broad points. And one was kind of a, advice to other pollsters, which,
Cool.
thing that happens a lot.
Yeah, sure.
You know, to be attentive to this and to make sure that in their polling that they're doing the campaign, they're really implicitly about campaign polling, I think. So it applies to everybody, to make sure that people are paying attention to sign, you know, using screens for engagement and paying attention to engagement, interest, kind of factors. But then the other was to ring the bell that if you did that, there were signs of danger. So, you know, maybe give a sort of the bullet of that memo.
Sure. Well, real quick, I mean, just to give, you know, you all a little background as a reminder, right? The share of voters who actually participate in these primaries is very, very, very small relative to the whole electorate. So, for example, you know, in this last election, 2026, as of March, was about 18.66 million registered voters, about 2.16 million voted in the Republican primary earlier this year, about 2.32 million voted in the Democratic primary earlier this year. That's for Senate, so really top of the ticket races, competitive races.
Competitive races on both sides.
On both sides.
So an interesting.
But in total, that's, you know, 11.6% of registered voters voted in the Republican primary, about 12.4% of registered voters voted in the Democratic primary. So what that means is that if we're trying to figure out runoff voters, in general, you don't want to just start with a list of registered voters, because what that means is that 9 out of 10 of those voters would not have been voting in your Republican primary if you're interested in Republican primary voters. And that's just a very expensive thing to do. So what pollsters generally do is they seek out voters who they know based on their past history have a high likelihood of participating in these races. And Chris, doing a lot of campaign polling during the cycle, is obviously calling these what we think of as reliable Republican or very likely Republican primary voters, which means people who have voted in past Republican primaries either once or twice, in some cases repeatedly.
Right.
In addition to that, what they do is they throw on what we call as a screen, and they say, you know, hey, are you intending to vote in the primary? Because even though you have in the past, and that is one of the biggest predictors, one of the things that they want to do is they want to make sure they're the right person. They want to make sure the intentionality is matching. They might ask some questions about how sure they are to participate. And what Chris's memo points out is that when they were polling these likely Republican primary voters, right, again, voters who regularly vote in Republican primaries, these voters were screening themselves out of the survey, which means they're telling them they're not going to participate at unusually high rates. Now, remember, all these professional pollsters, they've got data going back cycle after cycle. They keep the data. I keep all the data, you know, and they can look back and say, hey, is this high or is this low? And they're saying, hey, this is, and Chris is saying, hey, this is kind of unusually high, right? These are people that we think of as reliable Republican primary voters. And they're just sort of saying, no, we're not. And the real, I think, you know, the concern that goes above and beyond that is that the report notes, and I'll just put this as a quote from the report, of the voters who screened out of taking our survey. So again, these are, to jump back in for a second, Republican primary voters. So of the voters who screened out of our surveys, 35% ended up voting in the GOP primary.
Let's stop there for one second. You'll finish the, which in itself is an interesting thing.
Right.
In terms of, you know, having a reasonable sense of making judgments about what people are telling us about their future behavior.
And it's why we also know that past behavior is so predictive, right?
Right.
So again, of these voters who screened out the taking our survey, 35% ended up voting in the GOP primary. However, over half stayed home and 13% ended up switching parties and opting to vote into voting in the Democratic primary. And he goes even further on and says, you know, these 13% who switched, you know, they were less attached Republicans. They may have voted in one or two as opposed to many, which again should make sense to us. But I think, you know, one of the keys here that's, you know, important to point out is that given the importance of turnout overall to GOP success, especially in a year in which Democratic turnout is not expected to be a problem, if, let's say, less committed Republicans aren't showing up or don't feel like they're going to show up, that's the warning bell that he's ringing out there. And then the polling mechanism to that is to say, for all of us pollsters, is really be attentive to people's stated engagement, stated intentions.
Right.
Because right now, it's not just enough to look at their past history and know exactly what's going to happen. It's also not enough just to look at what they tell us, honestly, when you look at this. But
yeah,
that's another story. And so that's sort of the takeaway there. So that sort of picks up in some ways on something that we were talking about last week, right? Which is, you know, some of this is, you know, this is sort of.
Yeah, if you look at it, we use a very different measure.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And this is purposefully, I will say, you know, not surprisingly, the memo is purposefully vague, or I would say not vague, is purposefully determined not to point to any particular causes. It's just pointing out that this is something they're noticing. We were talking last week about the challenge in mobilizing Republican voters after this Senate runoff election, given that in our polling, you know, just from April, we found, you know, 50% of Republican registered voters in Texas said that they would be supporting both Cornyn and Paxton. But of course, that's only half.
Right. And this was in our two, you know, hypothetical head-to-heads right. between Cornyn and Tallarico and Paxton and Tallarico.
Right. So in 50% of Republicans said they would support Cornyn or Paxton. 10% they would support Cornyn but not Paxton. 13% they would support Paxton but not Cornyn. And then 26% were in the sort of mixture of undecided, unengaged in the race yet, what have right. you. And so that's another piece of this, which is to say, I mean, what's interesting about this in some ways, I'll throw this back to you here in a second, but this actually comes at it from a different angle. I mean, what I think Perkins is pointing out is that, you know, and I think this makes sense in a lot of the data that we see elsewhere, we could kind of cross tab this in a way, which is that, yeah, the less committed Republican voters are looking a little bit less committed than usual
right.
based on their historical. What we're looking at here in some ways is actually a different problem, because when we're looking at the Republican voters who would vote for one of Paxton or Cornyn, we're actually talking about a pretty engaged set of Republicans who've made a decided choice
right.
about one compared to the other. That's a different problem, right? That's about actually mobilizing engaged voters within your coalition. This is about the possibility of losing slightly less engaged voters who are still generally part of the coalition. But as of right now, for any number of reasons, which we could speculate on, Chris chooses not to fairly, you know, you might worry about mobilizing in November. So this is actually two different sides in some
yeah,
ways.
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a similar, you know, it's different dimensions it's of
a, yeah.
a similar broad problem,
right.
of the same broad problem, right? Yeah, I mean, I think... You know, I'm both struck, and then, you know, it triggers my skeptical
yeah.
instinct or something. But it is interesting to see the degree of interest in this subject right now, which, look, makes all the sense in the world. I mean, if you want an even, you know, more vague but still telling
yeah.
element of this— And if you go back to those two, it's kind of what triggered our interest in digging into these numbers more to begin
yeah.
with, and last week and then in the post. You know, it was pretty clear that there was an issue there that was driven by the dynamics of this runoff,
mm-hmm.
in which, you know, 80% of Democrats, and this is not surprising, were going to cast their vote for Tallarico in those matchups.
Right. And who he's up against.
Yeah. And it was, you know, yeah, it was both. But only about, you know, 60, I think it was 16, 61 or 62,
yeah.
right, were going to commit to either Paxton or Cornyn.
Among Republicans.
Among
right.
Republicans in that.
At this
and
point.
So, you know, in the most kind of thumbnail way possible,
mm-hmm.
you know, you look at that 20% gap between Democrats and mm-hmm. Republicans in terms of who's supporting their party's candidate.
Right.
And on one hand, I mean, it would be kind of dumb to expect otherwise,
yeah.
given the nature of this. But then you start looking at some of the numbers in Chris's report.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the kind of fave unfaves on Paxton and Cornyn mm-hmm. and the way that kind of, when you break that down, you know, and you're looking at a pretty decent share of Republican voters who, again, in the midst of a runoff in
right.
May, are still having trouble kind of both deciding, you know, rallying around the candidate during this runoff. And again, that mm-hmm. I don't want to make more of that than it is, because it would be crazy to think that
yeah.
given the intensity of that. But the numbers are, you know, in this realm of kind of a double digit level of concern among Republican voters.
Yeah.
You know, Republican primary voters. That bumps up against the math, and we talked about this last week, I think. We don't have to sort of revisit this, but depending on where you think the margin of that election is going to be by the time mm-hmm. we get to the fall, is enough to be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, as we
right?
talk—
and I think Chris's memo really crystallized that in a good way from a trusted voice.
Well, I think that's the thing that is sort of interesting here, which is that, you know, I mean, you sort of mentioned in starting your comment there, you know, you want to be—I mean, I think we all want to be skeptical. Right. I mean, and part of that is, look, Republicans have a majority identification of the electorate in Texas
yeah.
as a party. Right. They've won many, many elections here over and over and over again. They've got a resource advantage.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and really, like, as much as we're talking about the Senate race in Texas, you know, notice we're not talking about a lot of the other races
right.
on the ticket at this point. And I mean, it's going to be unlikely that those races are going to become super competitive, but we'll see. I mean, obviously, but that's
yeah.
like, that's very much on the outside edge. So I think there's a reason, as, you know, I would say consistent observers of Texas politics yeah. to be a little bit skeptical.
Yeah.
But, and this is the big but here, this isn't
yeah.
Democrats running around saying, oh my God, look at this enthusiasm gap. This is Republicans running around saying, hey guys, we're worried about this. Yeah. This is someone like Chris Perkins, very respected voice. I mean, you know, Republican pollster saying, you know, I see something here so much like I want to put this memo out here so that my brethren know that this is going on.
And I heard, you know, Mike Basilis making another long established Republican pollster making a very similar argument using different data, but you know, very recently. That's really who I thought this was going to be because they didn't put Ragnar in the email blurb when Quorum Report set it up. And I fully expected to see this actually being Basilis. So.
And it was Ross Hunt's analysis in the wake of the SC9 special. Yeah, another
variation on this.
It was sort of pointing out this is coming up in all quarters. And to your point, you know, you're talking to people, you know, sort of anecdotal thing. And, you know, I was talking to a reporter yesterday who was basically saying that, you know, she'd been talking to a lot of grassroots Republicans and sort of going to a lot of these community events that, you know, usually historically had been like kind of packed. And they're kind of empty. Now, again, this is all anecdote. And we're sort of talking about, you know, the chat, like, what is going on here? Like, what is this? And we could speculate now if we want to. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways one could. But it is just sort of just pointing to just, you know, there are problems and they're not being raised by Democrats. I mean, Democrats have their own problems and we'll talk about that at a different time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's not as though this is going to, I mean, you know, I think in some ways, I said this to you and we can kind of come back to this at some point. You know, if you look at the fundamentals of what's going on right now, you know, in some ways, it's only kind of the dysfunction among Democrats in general as a party that is not leading people to suspect that this is just going to be a wave election, like in some ways. Like that, I mean,
and I want to be clear. When I said it kind of tickled my, you know, it's not so much that I was, not at all actually, that I was skeptical of the data because the data all seem to be pointing in the right way.
Right.
It's that.
The same direction.
It's still a little, you know, it's May.
Yeah.
And the runoff is still going on. And I understand. I mean, I agree with the analysis, basically. I mean, we sort of were, you know, arrived at a similar place by a different route last week. But I guess it's the mixture of the analysis and the politics of this that make me want to just be a little careful and, you know, ringing the bell here. Because look, this is a strategic, the Republican campaign professionals that are raising this point are doing so for a reason.
Right.
Right. And I think, you know, the reason is they're looking at this analysis and they're seeing something they should see.
Right.
You know, but there, as you say, you know, the Democratic side of this also kind of matters. And, you know, and frankly, the Democratic side is harder to read.
Yeah.
Because there's just, you know, less money. Frankly, there's less money going into the analysis. There's less data to work with.
Right.
You know, in a lot of ways.
Right.
And the data is clouded by, you know, particularly the lack of name recognition among the candidates in the race not named Tallarico at this point.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
I mean, just to put that out there.
Right.
Okay, so let's go to this other thing that happened this weekend. We, you know, and it's, as you sort of said at the beginning, it's not unrelated to this, though it does have a substance all its own. And, you know, the point of departure for us on this, a little bit less, you know, universally discussed than at least in these circles than the Perkins memo was Alejandro Serrano's piece that posted Wednesday at the Texas Tribune website that was titled, interestingly enough, "For Texas GOP Immigration Politics Show Signs of Fading Potency." Potency was an interesting word, but I'm going to set that aside. Now, you know, obviously, Alejandro's piece made good use of Texas Politics Project polling data that we always like.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
You know, but it made a point that we have, you know, discussed in here a bit, but we really haven't, you know, we did put pen to paper, you know, whatever, fingers to keyboards on this, I think, in the fall of last year, kind of briefly. But, you know, the idea here is that something we've talked about on the podcast, that the primacy of immigration and border politics among Republican voters in the state has really declined.
Yeah.
And it's declined, you know, the most obvious reasons, which we've talked about in here a couple times. One, you know, that the border has gotten more quiet.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, second, that other issues have come to compete with immigration and border security in the responses of Republican voters when we're asking them what's important to you.
Yeah. And also, right? I mean, related to all that, you know, the attention of Republican elites has shifted from criticizing the federal government's handling of the immigration right. problem and of border security to praising the administration's handling of the same issue. And so that's just a different, it's a very different environment. So what do we see, right? Well, I mean, what yeah. we see, honestly, in the data is really an amazing kind of shift in attitudes over the course of, you know, really just over a few years, right? So if we go back to February of 2024, right? So, you know, during presidential election year, 68% of Texas Republicans said that immigration or border security was the most important problem state facing the state. So almost 70%. For comparison, 44% of independents registered the same opinion, 14% of Democrats. And this was at a bit of a high point, I think, as I recall. I mean, there's a bit of an uptick here.
Yeah, yeah. No, that period where we saw this kind of going up among Democrats, and it didn't, you know, start breaking the top of the graph or anything. But 14 was the second highest in a decade of data.
Right.
In which, you know, Democrats said that it was immigration or border security is the most important problem facing the state.
And if you look after COVID, between October of 2020 or the beginning of 2021, and honestly, the beginning or the end of 2024, at no point in time except for once did less than a majority of Republicans say that immigration or border security was the most important problem facing the state.
Right.
Again, this is given any possible problem.
And that was kind of during a COVID period, but also, you know, honestly, if you look at that data, it looks like a little bit of an outlier.
Yeah. So, but what happens, right? So February 2024, 68% of Republicans say immigration or border security is the most important problem facing the state. Trump assumes office. By February of 2025, that's dropped to 46%. That's a 22-point drop in a year. If we jump ahead to February of this year, another year ahead, it's dropped to about 25% at that point. And then as of April, it's down to 20%. And so we've seen since February of 24 to today, a drop of 48 points in the share right. of Republicans who say immigration and border security is the most important problem facing the state.
And since you mentioned the other voters, we should also notice that, you know, in our, you know, forever pinned discussion of independence, that independents, you know, are at a lower baseline level. Mm-hmm. I mean, independents are to have a baseline because they move around. But yeah. still, if you were to take the average or even don't take the average, the Republican lines and the independent lines are sort of parallel yeah. in their decline.
Right.
It's very clear on the graphic. If you, you know, if you're listening to this, you can also go to our website. We'll have the graphic on.
Well, right. I mean, just a similar way to put this. In February 2024, when Republicans were at 68%, independents were at 44%. Again, today, Republicans are at 20%, independents are at 8%. So 8% of independents say immigration or the border is the most important problem facing the state now compared to 44% back 2 years ago. And Democrats are down at 3%. It's negligible, the share right. of Democrats who choose this. So on the one hand, you know, to the point of the article, you know, this issue has lost its potency to some extent in that, as we say, you know, if you're sort of saying what is on the minds of Republican voters, historically, without doubt, you could say immigration and the border were top of mind for Republican voters
right.
almost universally throughout much of the last, you know, really you can go back over, you know, 10 years and right. say that. Now that's clearly not the case. And what's been replacing it, you know, obviously more concerns about the economy, which now at this point is in competition with immigration and the border among right. Republican voters for the top spot, especially now that oil prices and gas prices are increasing too. If you start to add in some of the other economic things besides economy, pricing, jobs, and gas prices,
yeah.
that's a pretty competitive bucket of issues at this point. Now, I think on the one hand, this, you know, creates
This is clear as day.
Yeah, this is clear as day, and it creates, you know, I think it does create something of a campaign challenge for Republicans trying to speak to Republican voters on the issues they care about. At the same time, you know, this doesn't mean that there's been an abandonment of the underlying issues that have driven concerns about immigration and border security, which really have to do with a lot yeah. more than just
yeah.
border
yeah,
crossings.
Yeah, and I would even, you know, not even, you know, the underlying attitudes, right?
Right.
I mean, there's a cluster of attitudes about immigration and immigrants that are still prevalent among Republican voters.
Right. So when we ask, you know, do you agree or disagree with the following statement, basically undocumented immigrants currently living in the United States should be deported immediately. So we say immediate deportation for all undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. Right now, as of April, or as of February, I think was the last time we asked this, 87% of Republicans agreed with this. That's tied for an all-time high in the survey going back to 2014. So we've been asking that question for over 10 years. That's as high as it's been among Republicans. Now, it's usually pretty high. It's usually, you right. know, it's been north of 80%
more or less with, you know, margin of error since 2021, but 87% is unequivocally the high point on that time series.
I mean, we used to, you know, we used to talk about how it was always well more than half.
Yeah, right.
Right. And yeah. And then, and I think the interesting thing to note is that even as, you know, these salience numbers have declined so clearly, you know, we've got a series of highs really over the last four or five polls.
Yeah. And what I should say, I mean, just because we're looking at it, I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, that are in the, you know, mid-80s.
Yeah. I mean, one of the challenges, I mean, again, for Republicans with this issue is that this attitude is actually crystallizing it, you know, even more so than it was before. At the same time, the share of independents who agree with that proposition is on the decline. Now, part of that is, I think, a lot of ways a performance issue, right? If you look at the Trump administration, we'll get to this, but the actual carrying out of mass deportations, you know, that's creating some issues here, obviously, among some other voters. And I think independents, you can really see that because the share of independents who agree with the immediate deportation proposition, 38%, is significantly lower than it was even in June 2024, really much of 2024, when it was as high as 55% consistently. And to think that that's not a reaction to, again, the performance here.
Yeah.
But to your point, you know, also, this is just about underlying its attitudes towards immigration, towards cultural change. So, you know, a lot of the times we get, you know, we could... I think we imagine, or there is the refrain, well, what about, you know, this is about illegal immigration. These are, this is about law breaking. But when we ask about legal immigration, which we ask a lot, again, we're thinking about underlying attitudes, nearly two thirds of Republicans, 65%, say that legally we allow too many immigrants into the U.S. as is. And that was as recently as February of this year. That is the plural, that's the majority position by far. 22% say about right. Only 5% of Republicans say that we're letting in too few immigrants.
Yeah, in the, you know, probably dozen plus times that we've asked that question since February of 2015, the Republican number has never been less than, you know, 59%, I think, is the lowest reading in that time series. And again, these have been, you know, on the high, you know, they were on the higher end in 25 and 26.
Right. So, so I mean, we take that to say that, you know, like on the one hand, while yes. And I mean, again, I agree with the point of that. I'm glad that the Tribune wrote that article because I think it's, it's been, I mean, to me,
it's been hanging out there for a while.
Well, the decline in saliency of immigration on the border has such a direct impact on the practice of state politics that it's hard not to understand a lot of what's going on in terms of these sorts of stories that we pick up without looking at that as sort of the central vector when you were thinking about, and we can talk about that, like the Islamification of Texas on one hand, or if we're talking about, you know, Abbott's sort of efforts to rein in local restrictions around police cooperation with ICE. This is all ways to vector back to an issue that in some ways has become a lot difficult, more difficult to vector around, right? But, I mean, as we said, like, look, you know, these underlying, the issue hasn't lost its, I mean, to your point, the potency thing. It's tough to say that the issue's lost its potency because the underlying attitudes are still just so obviously there, right?
It's looking for the, you know, as a campaign issue and as an incumbent Republican seeking to adjust to this environment, the trick, I think, and this is where we, you know, I mean, look, again, I'm with you. The article was great. I think it was a little overdue. I like it. But also, it's not so much that the issue is now kind of doesn't ring, you know, ring the bell for a lot of Republican voters. It's how you ring that bell.
Right, because the ultimate, because like, you know, this is what it comes,
and we're seeing, and just to,
yeah, go ahead.
And we're, you know, as you've said, and I think we're seeing a realization of that.
Yeah.
In state level governance strategy, and more specifically, the tactics being employed by statewide candidates, particularly the governor.
Right. Because I mean, I think, you know.
You know, the cities thing you mentioned, we can mention a couple of other things probably.
Yeah.
In which you can almost see a little bit of, you know, testing.
Yeah. Well, it's pushing the buttons, right? I mean, the thing about immigration and border security is it touches on real concerns that mostly Republican voters have about changes in society and culture,
right?
And immigration can be one vector for those changes, but there are other aspects that touch on those changes.
The Islamification of the state, for example.
For example, right? And so if you have a conservative, traditional, you know, largely, you know, Anglo view of what culture is in America, well, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, honestly, there's a lot of evidence that is changing.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, the trick is, you know, whereas it's easy to sort of say, let's focus on illegal border crossings. Well, when we can't talk about that anymore because the president has handled it, we have to shift our attention. But you're still touching something that is real to most Republican voters in a way that, you know, you need to do. And that's what Abbott's doing. And what we found in the polling in some ways is that And I mean, I think I'm going to kind of sum up a couple of the different things at once, which is just to say that, you know, staying in the area of law and order and police conduct is a really safe place.
Right.
We know from polling specifically about, you know, some of the methods of...
Well, by police conduct, you mean police cooperation with ICE, right? I mean...
Well, what I mean it even more broadly, because I just mean that there's a sense that, you know, once the police are involved with somebody, this becomes a law enforcement matter. And as a law enforcement matter, if you're dealing with people who've broken the law, whether that's a traffic violation or the immigration laws, ultimately there's something that I think is very comfortable to largely Republican voters in the state, that's something that should happen. It's a normative thing, right?
Well, and importantly, as we talked about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and just enough resonance with just enough Democrats and independent voters to...
Right. And so we see this in lots of pieces of data. We look at, you know, some recent data. We find that, you know, when we ask Republicans, I don't have to go into all the specifics of this. We've already talked about it. But, you know, about the actual methods, the mechanisms of sort of immediate deportation. Again, 80%, you know, or more approve of immediate deportation. Well, it's, you know, what about, you know, people who are at the hospital? Well, you know, 57 support, 36% oppose among Republicans, right? Same thing for arresting people who are at hearings related to their immigration status at courthouse, 57-32. Where you start to get a mix, of course, like kids at school, not very popular, right? People at the hospital, a lot less popular. But, you know, to the extent that Abbott has gone and started focusing on the cities and law enforcement, you know, it's not very hard to go back into the polling data and find that this is kind of a sweet spot in and of itself. Back in June of 2017, we asked about support or opposition to ensuring that police officers have the right to question a person's immigration status. And here during that, again, this was a while ago now, almost 9 years ago, but we found 68% of Republicans strongly supported ensuring the police officers have the right to question immigration status. 19% of Republicans somewhat supported that. Add that up, that's 87%.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a slam dunk, right? Sanctuary cities, we don't talk about sanctuary cities anymore, but this idea that local entities could basically not engage in immigration enforcement, essentially as just a general blanket policy. The state went to outlaw sanctuary cities. When we asked about, you know, approval or support or opposition for the notion of sanctuary cities, back in 2017, we have 80% of Republicans opposed to sanctuary cities, 72% strongly.
Right.
So in some ways, this is just kind of walking back to somewhere we've been before, which is focusing on, hey, police should enforce laws, immigration laws are laws. Let's, we support police.
Right.
Right. So it's a very comfortable space, I think, to be in, but it's also looking to get back into somewhere that in some ways is not top of mind for Republicans the way that it used to be.
Right. And I think, look, there's a lot of potential there still.
Oh yeah. Yes.
Right. But it's more difficult now, I guess is the point. And a lot of these patterns that we've been talking about since we started running these specific batteries, I think are now becoming kind of more apparent. I mean, it's kind of interesting to look at where the 50% threshold is among Republicans on there. You know, more than 50% of Republicans support in descending order, you know, the champ of all, reducing the number of foreign students allowed to enroll at colleges and universities. And that's not even really,
like,
technically an immigration enforcement mechanism. It kind of taps into a couple of different things. Yeah. It taps into higher ed, and it also taps into opportunity and economic factors. You know, 73% of that's far and ahead leader of the pack. And then right below that, you said arresting people who are in the country illegally while they're at a hospital, 57%, while they're at courthouses, 57%, arresting people while they're at church, even 55% among Republicans. So the gap is important.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, if you're 80-something percent saying deporting everybody, if you're losing 33% or 30% or so when you start arresting people at hospitals, you know, you could see that as the cost of doing business, but it is a limit.
But it's a cost. I mean,
but it is a cost.
And I think, you know, where you also see that cost is, again, going back to those independent numbers and how they've really evaporated on the immediate deportation number in a way that Republicans haven't. Because, again, from the performance perspective— they have similar view. I mean, in fact, their attitude towards the specific circumstances are significantly more negative than Republicans. And you look at that same set of attitudes, a majority of independents oppose deportations in all of the circumstances that were raised in that same poll. So
And you know, when you look at that, so looking at those gaps and the numbers, the point you're making, if we start tying these things together, if you're thinking about a base that you're worried is a little low on enthusiasm, and that may translate into a tendency to not turn out, you know, let alone cross over.
Right.
You know, being sensitive to these kind of enforcement blowback points becomes kind of key.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, look, it's, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but, you know, Abbott's attempts to sort of pressure the cities, and I don't even, you know, whatever, I mean, I would say, like, the politics around that are so, they're such winners. I mean, I think there's a little bit of an, there's a little bit of an outside exposure in the sense that, you know, who's defunding the police. We talked about this last time, but I mean, I think Abbott's people have, you know, responded to that and probably will be effective there. But the broader thing is you're talking about requiring police in Democrat run cities to cooperate with the Trump and his administration on its enforcement of immigration laws.
Yeah.
And that's something that no Republican voter in the state is going to have any problem with. I mean, just based on the plan, I mean, that's right. Like kind of just, you know, again, you can get into like, well, where are they enforced? Like, yeah, they're just doing their regular police business. You know, that's a very safe space for Abbott to be. But obviously the other problem is it's a little bit kind of abstract. You know, if you think about the kind of ads we've seen in the last couple of years, you know, the various kind of, here's this undocumented immigrant who murdered this person.
We've not been in a subtle space on this.
No, we haven't. And this is a lot more subtle, right, than where we've been. And so that's, you know, that's kind of the challenge. And that comes back to this notion of, you know, when we think about before these, this shift in attitudes, before this, you know, evaporation of attention to immigration the border among Republicans, you know, we would say what makes that issue so potent is that Greg Abbott could be in Eagle Pass. He could be in Midland. He could be in Collin County. It does not matter if he's talking about immigration, the border, and undocumented immigrants. He's talking to the issue that Republican voters care about.
Right.
And that's really powerful, especially given that, you know, you're kind of seeing this kind of, so just reading about also in the Tribune about the Julie Johnson, Colin Allred runoff, which is actually now to some degree on the Democrats, like, hinging on Allred's somewhat more conservative approach to immigration, which Democrats generally are just kind of like seeding the field on.
Yeah.
But that was why it was so powerful, right? Is because Democrats didn't really have an answer and Republicans could really be pretty evocative and provocative about the dangers, but they can't anymore because to be that way would be, you know, he says, we're to be in some extent a criticism of the president's handling of the issue. It would be sort of belying one of the main campaign. Honestly, I think something that Republicans are really going to hang their hat on in 2026, which is that they've addressed the border problem at least to some degree, right? And that, you know, you don't want to go back by letting Democrats. But even that, again, the challenge there is if that were talking to the issue that voters said mattered to them, maybe.
And you're still seeing that pop up in some of these runoff ads. You know, I mean, votes against border security, et cetera, are popping up like in the AG race. And, and even in the Cornyn. The Cornyn Paxton runoff, although it's a little more, you know, there's not been a lot of policy attacks in that race at this point.
Right.
I mean, but, you know, and I think, you know, one of the interesting things about this, I mean, a couple things I would add, I think one is that there is a general awareness of this, right, among Republicans, and that the Trump administration has clearly already tried to turn down the intensity. Mm-hmm. You know, they've, you know, ow, hot.
Yeah, right.
You know, in the aftermath of Minneapolis and the stuff in California, you know, the various, you know, high profile cases that were involved with that. But there's still internal dissent among that, apparently, inside the administration. Mm-hmm. They've turned, you know, they've kind of made these efforts less visible, less aggressive on the surface, but now there are people inside, you know, and, you know, broadly speaking, the kind of Stephen Millers of the world saying, hey, you know, we're not delivering this. Mm-hmm. And so they've got a little bit of a, so there's an interesting thing there. On one hand, the dynamic is at play within the administration. On the other, there's a clear realization among at least some people that they were paying a price for this.
Yeah.
And that they had, you know, they had over-delivered perhaps.
Well, it's interesting
in the way that they dealt with that.
It's not even like Democrats, you know, are looking to run on this issue per se, right? I mean, they're actually looking to run on the affordability issue, the price issue, the economy issue. And so this is just sort of floating around. But this is an issue that traditionally, regardless of everything else, Republicans have been able to lean on. And this is kind of where it ties back. Traditionally, this has been an issue where Republicans have been able to lean on this regardless of what's going on to mobilize the base.
Right. And count on Democrats not having much of a response. And, you know, to go back a little bit to where, you know, one of the things we flagged and put off for later, but, you know, Democratic, the lack of Democratic resources in the state to intervene on this at the state level, where Republicans have advantages and resources. And also, you know, as you were saying in a exchange yesterday, their party in government. You know, I mean, Greg Abbott can do a bit of trial and error here.
Right.
I mean, they can attack, they can try attacking the cities. They can try and, you know, maybe talking about immigrants and jobs, taking away, you know, they can try a few things and see what takes. And on the other hand, as you said, I mean, for, you know, 15 minutes, Democrats did have a response on the cities thing where they could have gone, oh, you're defunding the police.
Right.
But you know what? There was no infrastructure to, in that 15 minutes, whip up a quick ad and put it on the streamers and put it on social media that says, you know, and run it in the appropriate markets, but particularly in Houston and Dallas, you know, to run 15 or 30 second spots about it, saying big letters, you know, Greg Abbott defunds police in your city.
Here's where that money goes.
Right. I mean, there was nothing like that.
Yeah.
To my knowledge.
Right.
You know, and listeners, if you know of this, send them to us.
Sure.
You know, but that's another thing that occurs to me as we're talking about this, in which circling back to that Democratic structural disadvantage, I mean, you know, it's great to have, you know, Barack Obama show up and, you know, pay cash for tacos for the gubernatorial and Senate candidates. But that's not really, that's a great mobilization effort, but it's not really hitting at any soft spots.
Well, and I think to reinforce, I mean, you said something that I think is interesting, which is also like, you know, Abbott has the money and the inclination and the lack of potential cost, like outside of the cost of doing it, to test things. I mean, this early out, right? In the sense that, you know, he has the, again, he has, you know, again, the experience and the staff to go, you know, let's try this out. And then, you know, I mean, I would say it's like, you know, to your point, it would not be surprising to find out later if, you know, maybe never find it, like, oh yeah, they did that. And then they did it. We're doing a bunch of polling. They were testing, seeing how the messaging was working. And in some ways he gets to do that for all the Republicans in the state. And that's one of the benefits. And the fact that there isn't any sort of real Democratic infrastructure, like that's why there's not that much of a cost, because that counter message doesn't come up. And if he decides this isn't working, he can kind of slip out of it.
And look, to the people working on Democratic campaigns, we know you're working.
We know.
You,
we're talking about the resources.
We're not saying, we're not saying people aren't doing the best they can, but you know, the campaign finance number, the cash on hand in the campaigns came out, and Gina Hinojosa was reporting, I think, in rounding up to about 700 grand, I think. And Abbott had, you know, has been spending like crazy and had 90 something million. Right. And that's just, you can't. You know, you can't ignore this.
It's
both its direct impact and what it's telling you structurally about the parties.
Like, it's not a criticism. It's just an observation of the reality on the ground.
So, you know, anything else you wanted you tied that together on? I mean, I think that all kind of converges in, you know, a place that is, you know, pretty good for a podcast.
Yeah, I think so. I think I just want to give another like shout out hat tip to the Tribune on their piece on the data center story. They have a piece from, I think about now it's probably about 6 or 7 days ago, but it's about sort of the proliferation.
Rural pushback on data
centers. It's a really, really, really interesting story just because of just the nature of the way that the Republican politics of this are really complicated and it's really messy and it's really out in the open. I mean, there's sort of no one's really hiding it in some ways, but there's not really an answer to this at this point. And it's going to be curious to see kind of how this plays out. I mean, really from Trump to Abbott to the legislature to the local officials, how this plays out, because it's not, you know, I'm gonna say it's like, you know, we live here in Travis County in Austin, you know, land's pretty expensive here for a data center. You know where else really expensive? In Houston. All those sort of, you know, the places that kind of, so this is sort of a problem that's not really necessarily affecting the people in terms of growth that we usually think about.
And
so
and data centers are not something, are something that's a little bit harder sell to the YIMBY crowd. Right? This is not, that's not really what the YIMBYs are asking for.
So it's,
you know, I would also say about that, that's also, I kind of had that bubbling under in that it was one of the things about some of the interim hearings that we've seen in the utility and energy space, just how large that issue is looming right now.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, that's, yeah, I think we flagged this a few weeks ago, but it's worth flagging again. Yeah, that was a good piece in the Tribune. And I also think that that's going to be one of the, that's likely to be one of the big, very persistent, very consequential, not super sexy themes of the upcoming legislative session.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's just by upcoming, I mean the one that starts in January of 2027, which on one hand seems like far away, but for people working in the business, like I can attest, it is not. So, all right. With that, thanks for being here, Josh. Yep. Thanks for gathering all that data on that. Thanks again to our excellent production team in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin. Thank you for listening. If you're listening to this on a podcast platform, you'll find more supporting data and much more in a post at our website. You can find it throughout using our search engine. There'll also be a post with relevant data on it. That's at texaspolitics.edu, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. We'll be back soon with another second reading podcast. I think we're going to take next week off is the plan as we shift into summer mode and do a little cleanup on getting ready for the summer session and what we're coming out of in the fall. But we'll likely be back, I think, in 2 weeks with another second reading podcast. So keep an eye out and happy end of spring, beginning of summer out there. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.